allegedly turning his back on the Statue of Liberty. The media was driven to even more ferocious animosity against the president after riots erupted in Charlottesville, Virginia, on August 12th. What began initially as a peaceful protest by supporters of retaining a statue of General Robert E. Lee in the city's main square, joined fatally by a group of white nationalists, self-proclaimed Nazis, and the remnant of the Ku Klux Klan, degenerated into violence when it met even larger numbers of counter-protesters, made up of social justice groups but infested just as fatally by far-left radicals, broadly referred to as Antifa, many of whom arrived armed with batons and wearing their now familiar ninja outfits and evidently looking for a fight. The police effort to avoid violence was understaffed and sporadic, on orders, it later emerged, from the mayor, militant Democratic resistance to Trump leader Michael Singer. One person died when a white supremacist drove his car into a crowd of people, killing a young woman, Heather Heyer. The chief villains here, aside from the violent protesters themselves, were the mayor of Charlottesville and the governor of Virginia, former Democratic National Chairman Terry McAuliffe, also a wild-eyed anti-Trumper, who had allowed the protests to escalate like this, either out of sheer negligence or in the cynical hope of reaping some political gain, though the media quickly laid the blame with President Trump. Trump, in a series of statements, clearly condemned the violence and the extremists, and acknowledged that there were extremists on both sides. That was entirely true, but the national and international media professed to see in this moral equivalence between the two groups a comparative vindication of the Klan and the American Nazis. Numerous members of White House business and cultural advisory boards retired to protest Trump's apparent indifference to racism. As one analyst, Don Luskin, noted in remarks that were quoted in the Wall Street Journal, such reactions, and especially the reaction of the media, amounted to a clinical case of mass hysteria and one of the strangest we've ever seen. It's not about the event itself. It's about President Donald Trump's reaction to the event. And it's not even about whether Trump is a racist. It is self-evident that he is not. His sin is that he has failed to express his outrage at the event in a particular way, or more precisely, that he has expressed it in a way that doesn't kowtow to the identity politics lobby. Just so. And Trump, with almost stylish contemptuousness, folded the boards and said advisory boards never accomplish anything anyway. The racist charge was still imputed to the president at every opportunity. And that and the bunk about misogyny were still all the Democrats really had to fight with. But Trump's awareness by now of the disposition of the media to lever or fabricate anything into a club to beat him with should have warned the president to choose his words more carefully. Trump was constantly derided by the national media as suspect in his relations with Russia and as a distracted president who was struggling against tightening inculpatory evidence. But there was never any corroborative evidence for any of the sinister allegations against him. CNN and MSNBC announcers periodically referred to the drip, drip, drip of the controversy. That was a better description of the commentators themselves. But there was no such momentum behind it. Weeks went by without a damaging leak on the subject, other than to indicate improprieties by the Justice Department and the FBI. Much of the rest of the summer after late July 2017 was taken up with arranging and distributing emergency assistance to hurricane victims in Texas, Florida, and Puerto Rico. The pettiness of much of the anti-Trump media was exposed by criticism of Melania Trump for boarding the official aircraft to go to Texas wearing high heels. She disembarked in running shoes to go with casual attire, suitable for visiting flood-damaged areas. Mrs. Trump has perfected the technique of rising above these tribulations with elegantly calculated disdain. As in most good marriages, her husband could learn something from her. The administration was determined to avoid the public relations disaster that befell President George W. Bush over Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans in 2005. President Bush arrived late, joked about his rowdy antics as a young man in New Orleans, congratulated the emergency director, and then departed when the city was in desperate straits, with a quarter of the police having defected and thugs and vandals and looters dominating sections of it for several days, and snipers shooting at rescuers and aid distributors. The Houston area and the middle and west coast of Florida enjoyed better local government, were better prepared, and the federal government was ready with massive emergency relief. And the president and his wife visited as soon as they practically could and came through the natural disasters with flying colors. Puerto Rico was more of a challenge because of its insularity, comparatively primitive electric and transport systems, and the relative vulnerability of much residential construction on the Caribbean island. Desperate for her 15 minutes of fame, San Juan Mayor Carmen Yulín Cruz had time to custom make a T-shirt saying, "Help us, we are dying," before her interview with CNN's Anderson Cooper, blaming Trump for an inadequate federal government response. Geraldo Rivera, who interviewed her for Fox News, challenged her statement, saying he had been around the island and saw nobody dying. She responded, "Dying is a continuum," making her correct in that all people die, but it was a shabby performance, though much appreciated by the anti-Trump media, which was less impressed by the much more impressive governor of Puerto Rico, Ricardo Rosello, who holds a Ph.D. in biomedical engineering and is a centrist liberal, who praised President Trump and the federal government for its relief efforts. Not to be left behind in the hair-trigger, blame-Trump sweepstakes, Senator Bernie Sanders cited the hurricanes as evidence of the dangers of climate change, as if there had not been hurricanes of equivalent force, at least since the times of Columbus, and the treatment of the Puerto Ricans as illustrative of Trump's racism. The Trump's visit to the island and the great relief effort mustered for it certainly debunked such asinine comments. On August 23rd, Trump spoke to a large crowd in Phoenix for 77 minutes. Outside, protesters hurled projectiles and had to be dispersed by police using tear gas. Trump, as he generally does at these political revival and inspiration sessions, excoriated his opponents and taunted his media enemies. He had made it clear, again, that he condemned racism in the Charlottesville controversy, as he had. But the antagonistic media had invested in the argument that he had not. 2 days later, he pulled the media's tail by pardoning Sheriff Joe Arpaio, the 85-year-old former sheriff for 24 years of Maricopa County, Arizona, who had been convicted by federal prosecutors for criminal contempt of federal laws against racial profiling and for the illegal detention of illegal immigrants. The media inevitably took this as another indication of Trump's racism. On August 30th in Springfield, Missouri, in the heart of Trump country and in between visiting hurricane sites, the president unveiled his tax reform plan and spoke for it in a series of meetings around the country through the late summer and autumn. The plan proposed a one-page tax return, the shrinkage of the escalating brackets to four levels of reduced taxation, a 20% corporate tax rate down from 35%, and the elimination of most deductions except charitable gifts and mortgage payments. State income taxes would not be deductible against federal tax, putting the pressure on New York, California, and Illinois, three states Trump lost by a total of 7 million votes in 2016, which are all chronically strapped for cash and have raided the cookie jar of state income taxes at the federal government's expense. The incomes of the country's often over-endowed and educationally inadequate universities, which were almost uniformly leftist, would also be lightly taxed. It was a well-crafted Trump measure, and the Treasury Secretary, Steven Mnuchin, had prepared his bill much more carefully than Tom Price had written up the Obamacare repeal and replace measure with Speaker Paul Ryan. After 7 months, the Republican leaders in the Congress were effectively acting as if they held the balance between the president and the congressional Democrats. They seemed to be waiting to see if this radically different but generally moderate in policy terms president would be taken down by the venomous Democratic crusade against him in the Russian collusion investigation and elsewhere. If not, and the president prevailed and seemed to be driving a bandwagon they should climb aboard, they would do so, even while holding their noses. Trump moved to break up this very tedious and irresponsible waiting game by having the Democratic congressional leaders, Senator Chuck Schumer and former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, to the White House for dinner on September 13th, including Chinese food, for which Schumer, whom Trump worked with in New York for years, had a well-known fondness. They sat purring like tabbies on the Oval Office sofa and agreed to $15.25 billion of hurricane relief for Texas and Florida and to extend the raise in the debt ceiling for 3 months. This sent a message to Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and Speaker Paul Ryan. Trump effectively seized the balance of power for himself and made it clear that he would deal with whichever party could bring him results. The congressional Republicans had already failed him on health care, and if he could cut deals with the Democrats that would pass, he would do so. The administration's olive branch to the Democrats was presaged by the decision of the Attorney General, and presumably the President, not to indict former senior Justice Department official Lois Lerner for harassment of Republican political action committees. As the Mueller and other investigations chugged along, the media refused to recognize what was rapidly apparent. The Democrats had more legal problems than the Republicans. No one could now seriously believe that Trump had colluded with Russia in the election, trading promises of policy shifts favorable to Russia in exchange for cyber leaks. It was a mad proposition, and it became clear from the antics of the leaders of both parties in the Senate Intelligence Committee that all they had as evidence was the discredited Steele dossier. Republicans wanted the FBI to explain its role in funding the Steele dossier and in conducting legally questionable surveillance, especially telephone intercepts on the Trump campaign. They also wanted answers on whether the FBI was complicit in the illegal revelation to the media of the names of Trump campaign officials unmasked in intelligence reports. Obama's national security advisor, Susan Rice, and his ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Power, appear to have been aggressively demanding publication of the names of Trump campaign officials in order to imply that their conduct had been improper or suspect. It was now known that FBI Director Comey had written a draft exoneration of Mrs. Clinton before she was even questioned by the FBI about her emails. He had been investigating both candidates in mid-campaign and had taken it unto himself to announce that Mrs. Clinton, despite her serious misjudgments and apparently dishonest replies to FBI questioners, should not be prosecuted, followed by the panicky interlude when the Bureau reviewed the new batch of emails discovered on the server of former Congressman Anthony Weiner. Comey had already acknowledged that he told the president 3 times that he was not a suspect in the Russian collusion question. Trump was inaugurated 4 months after the FBI took over trying to chase down Steele sources to get to the truth. So the continued exposure of Trump to the innuendos of the hostile media and the leprous uncooperativeness of the congressional Democrats, as if he were in a legal purgatory, were unjustified by the legal facts. Comey's frank assertion that he had leaked his own contested version of what had occurred about the investigation of General Flynn in his dinner conversation with the new president on January 27th was a damaging admission, though the media did not treat it so. It was a criminal act if the memo to himself is considered a government document, which is legally probable, as Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein confirmed to Congress on December 13, 2017. Comey had unwittingly contributed to the gradual shift of the balance of legal forces in favor of the administration and against the Democrats, a gradual shift that included the increasing congressional attention finally being paid to the questionable activities of the Clinton Foundation, then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and other members of the Obama administration, including possibly Robert Mueller, who had been director of the FBI when Russia was permitted to buy 20% of America's uranium extraction capacity. The transaction required the approval of the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, which includes representatives from 16 U.S. departments and agencies, including the Secretary of State. By the time the committee approved the Uranium One sale, the FBI had already gathered a huge amount of evidence of bribery and kickbacks against a top official at the American subsidiary of the Russian company that was buying Uranium One. This and other evidence, including large pledges to the Clinton Foundation by parties with an interest in Secretary Clinton's goodwill, did raise great suspicions, however much the media wanted to downplay it. President Trump, meanwhile, had considerable success, domestically and internationally, with his forceful address to the United Nations General Assembly on September 19th. He warned North Korea and its leader, whom he had nicknamed Rocket Man, of the dangers of proceeding with his military nuclear program. He denounced the impoverishment and usurpation of freedom in Venezuela. He called for reform of the United Nations. He defined his policy of America First as the simple pursuit of America's national interest. And he renewed America's pledge to oppose terrorism everywhere. The international soft left was repelled, but domestic opinion was quite positive. The speech was well-crafted and well-delivered. The following day, he met again with the president of Egypt, Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, and indicated that he would lift the embargo on military aid imposed by President Obama, which he duly did. The sanctimonious hypocrisy of Trump's Hollywood and media critics soon came to the forefront with the exposure of prominent movie producer and Clinton fundraiser Harvey Weinstein's alleged sexual assault and intimidation of actresses in large numbers and over decades, which caused him to be cast out of the City of Angels like Lucifer. Weinstein was lynched on the basis of a carefully assembled article in the New York Times and a follow-up in the New Yorker. Apparently, his conduct had been notorious throughout the industry for many years, and he had banked on the assumption that his generous support of left-wing candidates and causes would insulate him from criticism, and that more donations and liberal professions would save him after he was exposed. The whole lurid story laid bare the preposterous presumption of the entertainment industry to lecture the American people on politics and morals. Hollywood is a moral and intellectual pigsty, an asylum for the stupid, the corrupt, and the vocally shallow, who possess thespian aptitudes or a saleable appearance and manner. On September 22nd, Trump denounced professional football players who kneeled during the playing of the national anthem before the games. This began with Colin Kaepernick, former quarterback of the San Francisco 49ers, who remained seated during the national anthem in protest against what he considered the routine practice of white American police to shoot unarmed African Americans, preferably killing them or, in his words, "I am not going to stand up to show pride in a flag for a country that oppresses black people and people of color. There are bodies in the street, and people are getting paid leave and getting away with murder." The movement grew, and in an address at Huntsville, Alabama, Trump threw into a stump speech for a senatorial primary candidate the opinion that players who did not stand for the anthem should be fired. His words were, "Fire the son of a bitch." Liberal opinion was offended, and so were almost all the football owners and many of their players. Trump said anyone could protest anything they wanted, but that well-paid NFL players enjoying a short working season should not hijack the National Football League and offend the sensibilities of their fans by affronting the flag, the servicemen and women who stand behind it, the national anthem, and the country generally. The exchanges escalated, and he called for a boycott of the NFL. Attendance fell 20% in the first week after Trump's statement, and by year-end, the NFL was suffering a serious desertion of fans, who lean conservative, and advertisers. It might have cast a damper over one of the nation's most popular sports, but the NFL's absurdly overpaid commissioner, Roger Goodell, the grandstanding, unsympathetic overpaid players, and the owners of the immensely overvalued teams were the real losers in public opinion. Trump is so hyperactive that, apart from North Korea, no particular issue lingers long. He swiftly moved on to other subjects. On health care, he virtually eliminated Obamacare's advertising budget, which had been set up to encourage public participation, and announced on October 12th that he would stop supplementary payments to insurance companies, which were meant to compensate them for the unanticipated, by the Obama administration, they were predicted by everyone else, costs of Obamacare. The Democrats tried to whip up public lamentations about shortchanging those of modest means, but as it was just a payoff to insurance companies and was unconstitutionally conceived and imposed, the general public dismissed the Democrats' hysteria. On October 13th, Trump declined to certify that Iran was in compliance with the six-power accord negotiated by the Obama administration. Trump recognized that the agreement, which governs fissile material, is unverifiable and ignores both Iran's progress toward developing a nuclear warhead and its accelerating program to develop and manufacture sophisticated long-range missiles. Foreign policy hawks applauded Trump's realism, even as many on the left booed Trump for lacking their sophisticated defeatism. There were other signs that the febrile Trumpophobes were weakening, though like cornered animals, their attacks became more vicious and unhinged. The resistance to his tax moves was relatively temperate and usually confined to the inevitable mantra that it was just a payoff to the rich, demonstrably as false a claim as it was predictable. Senator Corker of Tennessee, chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, uttered a few asides and hesitant comments in late September and October to the effect that Trump was unstable and that Secretary of State Tillerson, Defense Secretary Mattis, and Trump's Chief of Staff, General Kelly, were very exasperated and had to work full-time to keep Trump from doing something dangerously wrong-headed or provocative. Corker and Trump had the usual war of words, and as Corker could not be reelected in Tennessee without Trump's endorsement, he said he would not run again. While Corker played coy with the media, which assumed his support for Trump's tax bill was in doubt, he eventually voted for it. Another controversy erupted when it was reported from anonymous sources that Secretary Tillerson had called Trump a fucking moron, though Tillerson denied the report. Had he really said that, it is unlikely he would have retained his post or even wanted to keep it. When asked by reporters, Tillerson, a Southern gentleman, responded with, "I'm not going to dignify that question," which the press predictably reported as confirmation of the rumor. Trump unnecessarily responded, "I think it's fake news, but if he did that, I guess we'll have to compare IQ tests," which was funny, but not helpful to his cause. On October 30th, Mueller indicted former Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort and his associate Rick Gates for financial offenses allegedly committed years before Manafort knew Trump, and on the insidious charge of conspiracy against the United States. Mueller had organized a pre-dawn Gestapo or KGB-style raid on Manafort's home on July 26th, with armed men barging into the bedroom when Mrs. Manafort was in her sleeping attire, as people frequently are when sleeping in their homes at night. The new cry after this excitement subsided was that the 25th Amendment, Section 4, could be applicable, by which the cabinet could vote to remove Trump by reason of mental incompetence. This was as absurd an idea as the national publicity campaign to urge members of the Electoral College to repudiate their pledges to vote for Trump. It was the lowest depth yet plumbed by the Trumpophobes. The resistance was verging on mental incapacity itself. The 25th Amendment was designed to deal with a severe medical failure, as in the case of President Wilson when he was incapacitated by a stroke, not with policy differences or illegalities. It was contemplated once when President Reagan was shot, but he recovered so quickly there was no need for it. In other desperation moves, the anti-Trump forces unearthed the antiquarian and totally inapplicable Logan Act, 1799, which prohibits unauthorized people from trying to conduct American foreign policy, and which they charged should be invoked against the then-president-elect Trump and his staff for meeting with foreign officials, as if this were not common, accepted diplomatic practice. And there were repeated fatuous murmurings about the president obstructing justice when he exercised his constitutional right as chief of the executive branch to fire the inept and universally distrusted, up until Trump fired him, whereupon he instantaneously metamorphosed into the patron saint of the Democrat Party, FBI Director James Comey. Trump's enemies were grasping at straws. Chapter 12, Gaining the Upper Hand. In late October, the greatest explosion yet in the whole Trump-Kremlin collusion controversy was detonated by the Washington Post from leaks that were sprung by the squeaking wheels of justice. The Clinton campaign and Democratic National Committee had taken over the Fusion GPS anti-Trump research originally commissioned by Trump's never-Trump Republican opponents after Trump clinched the Republican nomination, and ramped it up, approving and bankrolling the assembly of the Christopher Steele dossier to the extent of approximately $10 million. This financed a very scurrilous pastiche of what even Comey called salacious and unverifiable material, and Bob Woodward called garbage. The Mueller and congressional investigations appeared to be based on this nonsense, mere campaign dirt in political parlance, and congressional committees had issued subpoenas to the Justice Department and the FBI, requiring witnesses and evidence about their involvement in the Steele dossier. The subpoenas were ignored, and there was soon agitation to cite the department and bureau for contempt of Congress. Trump was careful not to order Justice Department compliance with the subpoenas issued by the Republican majorities and be retarred with the frayed brush of obstruction. But he also did not try to discourage his congressional supporters from impugning the impartiality of the Mueller investigation and the competence of the Justice Department and the FBI. On January 4th, Rosenstein finally agreed to hand over documents congressional committees had subpoenaed under threat of a contempt of Congress citation, and Senators Chuck Grassley, Judiciary Chairman, and Lindsey Graham asked the Justice Department for a criminal indictment of Christopher Steele. They alleged that Steele had lied in a civil trial in London or to the FBI and had feloniously shopped his dossier to the press while under obligation to the FBI. This was another startling turn of events. The Senate Intelligence Committee leaders, Republican Richard Burr of North Carolina and Democrat Mark Warner of Virginia, acknowledged that they could go no further without Justice Department and FBI responses to their questions about the Steele dossier. This same Senator Warner had been proclaiming 9 months before that there had been upwards of 1,000 paid internet trolls working out of a facility in Russia, generating fake news, which was broadcast to Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. He implied that the Russians had delivered Wisconsin to Trump. Again, a completely unsubstantiated charge, and even Comey had said that Russia's efforts had not influenced the outcome of the election. Hillary Clinton's woeful memoir on the election, What Happened? Not a Question, almost accuses Trump of treasonable collusion with the Russian government to defeat her, citing exclusively Steele dossier sources, never mentioning that her own campaign commissioned and paid for it, presumably with her knowledge given the scope, cost, and implications of the work. Thus, the source cited for her heinous accusation was her own slime-smearing operation, which she henceforth described as campaign information. The Washington Post, having broken the story, acknowledged that the fact that the Clinton campaign had financed the Steele dossier provided Republicans with a talking point, but without admitting how grievously it compromised the whole Russian collusion issue, especially as many of Steele's sources were themselves Russian, perhaps peddling official disinformation, which would lead an impartial observer to wonder who, in fact, was colluding with the Russians, if not the Clinton campaign. Mueller's investigation tried to maintain momentum by indicting General Michael Flynn, who on December 4th pleaded guilty to a single charge of lying to federal officials, something Comey said he thought Flynn had not done. As the charge of collusion collapsed, under the implications of the fact that Mueller was essentially investigating the incumbent president on the basis of slanders collected and paid for by the defeated presidential candidate, the hope flared up in the resistance and what was left of the never-Trumpers that Flynn might inculpate the president. This was unlikely, as a cooperative witness would have had to confess to participation in the principal alleged offense, Russian collusion, which Flynn did not do. Flynn was pleading guilty to what Trump had fired him for, lying about conversations with the Russians and specifically the Russian ambassador in Washington, who had since been recalled. This appeared to be a mouse-trapping operation, as the Obama administration seemed to have relied also on the Steele dossier to obtain a Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act warrant to intercept the Trump campaign and transition team telephone conversations. There is also the possibility that on the strength of this, various names of Trump campaign personnel were illegally unmasked and leaked to the media as well, from intercepted conversations with Russian diplomats, which would not in themselves need a FISA warrant, but the unmasking would. This would have been part of the departing administration's effort to inflate the Trump-Russian collusion case as high explosions on a short fuse to discommode the incoming administration. There would be the added benefit of breathing fetid air into Hillary Clinton's limp argument that the Kremlin and Comey had cheated her out of the election. Just as the Steele dossier, apparently the entire basis for the Trump-Russia sham, was crumbling, a torrent of revelations about apparent conflicts of interest among what months earlier the media was referring to as Mueller's dream team was pouring into the public domain. Mueller removed senior intelligence officer Peter Strzok in July for texting thousands of anti-Trump messages to his girlfriend, who was also an FBI official on Mueller's team, Lisa Page. It soon emerged that the same Strzok had persuaded Comey in July to describe Hillary Clinton's conduct in the email affair as extremely careless, rather than the criminal description grossly negligent. This was also the same Strzok who had conducted the FBI interview of General Flynn. Mueller had withheld the reason for removing Strzok from his investigation until his virulently anti-Trump texting with Ms. Page was leaked. The leaks were now flowing both ways, as the balance of forces in Washington on the Russian collusion issue shifted toward the president and away from his accusers. Within 2 days of the revelation of the Strzok affair, it emerged that a senior justice official, Bruce Orr, had been demoted for an improper contact with the Russians and with Christopher Steele. Then it emerged that his wife, Nellie Orr, a Russian expert, had worked on the Steele dossier for Fusion GPS. There were also plausible but unconfirmed reports that another of Mueller's investigators had disposed of 2 large batches of email for Mrs. Clinton in that matter, and that many of Mueller's people had been Hillary Clinton contributors. One of them had attended the Clinton election night celebration that did not, in the event, have much to celebrate, and later sent an email to former Deputy Attorney General Sally Yates, professing to be so proud of her for being fired for insubordination by the new president. There were endless rumors of further indiscretions. It could not have been more different from the previous special investigations of Presidents Nixon, Reagan, and Clinton. Under Trump, the investigators were now being swarmed by doubters. Congressional Republicans snapped and tore at the vulnerable facades of the Justice Department and FBI, which had been highly politicized under the previous administration. The president said the FBI's reputation was in tatters, December 16th. Justice and FBI witnesses were badly mauled before congressional committees, and the deputy director, Andrew McCabe, was implicated in anti-Trump activities in one of Strzok's text messages. McCabe's wife had been a Democratic state Senate candidate in Virginia and had received $467,500 from a PAC controlled by Virginia Governor and Clinton intimate Terry McAuliffe. 3 months after his wife's failed election bid, Comey appointed McCabe deputy director of the FBI with oversight of the Clinton emails matter. It was announced just before Christmas that McCabe would be retiring from the FBI in April, as soon as he was eligible for a full pension. But he abruptly departed on January 29th after the new FBI director, Christopher Wray, saw a memo about to be released by the Republican majority of the House Intelligence Committee condemning use of the Steele dossier to obtain a FISA warrant on minor Trump campaign advisor Carter Page. Trump continued to cooperate with Mueller and gave the FBI graduating class and rank and file a stirring address of support that was strongly applauded on December 15th. Trump's tactics in supporting the institutions and their personnel, while the attempted politicization of them was being steadily exposed, was sophisticated and effective. As it became clear the tide was finally turning, most Democratic politicians were now rather circumspect, except for the egregious Congressman Schiff, who produced his own memo that the Justice Department requested be withheld because of its revelations of classified information. The anti-Trump case was in full disintegration by early 2018. In the special election to fill the Senate seat vacated by Attorney General Jeff Sessions, Trump parted ways with his former strategist Steve Bannon, endorsing Luther Strange in the Republican primary. Bannon's candidate, Roy Moore, won the primary runoff, and the media trumpeted it as a Trump loss. They adapted their tune, but not its theme, as the story developed. In early November, the hyperactive Washington Post opened another front with the aid of militant feminist lawyer Gloria Allred and unveiled complainant Lee Korfman, who alleged that 38 years before, when she was 14, Moore had fondled her over her clothing. Allred, in a career of 40 years of relentless controversy, had been involved in scores of sex-related cases, many of them frivolous and vexatious. Her targets included Donald Trump, very late and implausible, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Rush Limbaugh, Michael Jackson, Senator Robert Packwood, Anthony Weiner, Herman Cain, Bill Cosby, Tiger Woods, Meg Whitman, head of eBay, and Roman Polanski. Ms. Allred is something of an ultra-feminist Roy Cohn in drag. Moore denied the allegations, but was a peculiar candidate regardless, having been twice elected and twice removed as Chief Justice of Alabama for an unauthorized construction of a large monument to the Ten Commandments within the courthouse, and later for refusing to accept constitutional approval of same-sex marriages. He had been a supporter of the absurd birther movement against President Obama, was a fundamentalist Christian, and was apt to wave a firearm around at election meetings to show his support for the Second Amendment. As it turned out, Trump's political instincts were far better than Bannon's. Strange would have won the seat easily. It was a safe Republican seat. But Moore, dogged by endless unfolding controversy, lost by 20,000 votes out of more than 1.2 million cast. Trump could do without the Moore stigma, but Republican control of the Senate, with elections looming in 2018, was very unstable. By now, it was clear that the Democrats thought they had a new Waterloo for Trump on the imperishable misogyny issue. But unfortunately for them, a litany of prominent media and Hollywood personalities, most of them associated with the left, were soon forced out of their careers on the basis of an avalanche of post-Weinstein sex-related grievances, and so were Democratic politicians. Democratic Senator Al Franken of Minnesota, a former comedian, was accused by a Republican talk show hostess and former prominent model of lewd behavior when they were preparing for a USO tour in 2006, and had a somewhat corroborative photograph. This unleashed the customary sequels of other ostensible victims. Franken denied the subsequent claims and remembered the original one differently. He put himself in the hands of the Senate Ethics Committee. The 27-term Dean of the House of Representatives, African-American Democrat John Conyers, was also accused, and at first defended by former Speaker Nancy Pelosi as an icon. When the Democratic leadership assessed the potential of the Moore issue, and further complainants came forward against these and other politicians, they swiftly forced the retirement of Franken and Conyers. They went with docility, victims for the cause. Overall, media claims that Trump was a boorish misogynist ricocheted around rather hollowly. As to their own collective embarrassment, it seemed as though Hollywood and the media itself harbored the greatest quantity of misogynists and sexual harassers in the country, as new allegedly guilty parties were revealed on a daily basis, including liberal news lions like Charlie Rose and Matt Lauer. There were more scandals of a more political nature to come. Shortly after the revelation that the Clinton campaign and Democratic National Committee had taken over the Fusion GPS anti-Trump operation and engaged Christopher Steele, former Democratic chair Donna Brazile published a book claiming that Hillary Clinton and her campaign had strangled the Democratic National Committee financially and had rigged primaries against Senator Bernie Sanders, contrary to the Federal Election Campaign Act. It was Ms. Brazile, as WikiLeaks revealed just after the election, who had given Mrs. Clinton advance notice of questions because, as she later explained, "I did not want Hillary to be blindsided by questions." She appeared to be oblivious to the fact that a main purpose of such a debate is to test candidates' familiarity with issues. Mrs. Clinton's denial of the Brazil primary rigging charges was rather perfunctory, but Elizabeth Warren, the leftist Democratic Massachusetts senator, agreed that Mrs. Clinton had stolen the nomination from Sanders. A couple of days later, as the sexual harassment tide rose, New York Democratic Senator Kirsten Gillibrand said President Bill Clinton should have resigned the presidency because of the sexual outrages he committed. This gave the Republicans, including President Trump, tweeting to his scores of millions of followers, and conservative talk show hosts, the opportunity to rake over the Democrats' earlier dismissal of complainants against Bill Clinton's conduct as bimbos and trailer trash, and tools of a vast right-wing conspiracy. Trump claimed that Gillibrand in her previous campaigns had begged him for financial assistance and said she would do anything for it, which Senator Elizabeth Warren denounced as an attempt to slut-shame Gillibrand, which did not do Gillibrand any favors. Indeed, the whole delirious attempt to co-opt the post-Weinstein Me Too movement as a political weapon against Trump backfired nearly every day. Caitlin Flanagan wrote a piece in The Atlantic titled Reckoning with Bill Clinton's Sex Crimes, which reminded Democrats that they already had a lot to answer for when it came to sexual harassment. This cascade of revelations and the failure of Hillary Clinton's election memoir to be taken seriously as an explanation for her defeat compromised the position of the Clintons in public esteem. Investigations of her emails and the Clinton Foundation resumed. The book was a toe-curling exercise in blaming everyone else for her electoral loss. Churlish denigrations of Trump and his supporters were scattered throughout the book. Her masquerade as a loving intellectual, every day a celebration of her idyllic and faithful Norman Rockwell Pleasantville marriage to Bill, strained credibility even among long-serving Clinton supporters. At the same time, the Clintons and Obama were struggling in the quagmire of having commissioned the Steele dossier, foisted it on the FBI as Steele shopped it to the most scurrilous media sites, and then invoking it as if it were a serious work of independent sleuthing in accusing Trump of acts of treason. This and the unplumbed depths of the email and uranium controversies appeared likely eventually to ooze out sluggish and filthy. While the Democrats were engaged in unwitting acts of self-destruction, the president had a very successful trip in November to Japan, China, South Korea, Vietnam, and the Philippines. The Chinese president, Xi Jinping, publicly emphasized that China entirely shared American determination that North Korea not become a nuclear military power. Trump claimed progress on trade and monetary differences and picked up tangible investment pledges of $250 billion. And appeared to have reached a complete state of solidarity with Seoul and Tokyo opposite North Korea. Even the most demonically hostile elements of the anti-Trump media could find no fault with his performance and accomplishments, an unprecedented occurrence. Unable to find legitimate cause to criticize the president, CNN's coverage focused on how Trump allegedly overfed the koi fish at Akasaka Palace during a photo op with Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. Though this turned out to be another instance of fake news. CNN contradicted the president's medical report and spuriously alleged that he had heart disease. On December 7th, President Trump announced that the U.S. Embassy in Israel would be moved to Jerusalem. There was the usual outcry from the Russians out of sheer hypocrisy as they had made the same move in April 2017. China, which prefers Americans to be mired in Middle East disputes. Western Europe, which has never had any policy in the region except to await the American position and take a stand more favorable to the Arabs, and the Arab and other Muslim powers. The Czechs and Hungarians indicated that they might follow the Americans, as Guatemala did, and Canada and Australia and many other countries were very judicious deferring statements of any sort. The anti-Israeli left in America wrung its hands even more vigorously than usual. Rioting, however, was almost entirely confined to Gaza and the West Bank, and by the standards of the region, was minor. The Israelis, whose competence at dispersing Palestinian mobs has been amply demonstrated, had no difficulty dealing with riots in Israel-occupied territory. The whole alignment of forces had changed in the Middle East. Israel's formerly most ardent enemies aren't enemies. Iraq and Syria have disintegrated. Saudi Arabia and Egypt are now Israeli allies against Iran. The Arab governments had used the Palestinians to distract the Arab masses from the misgovernment they were inflicting on them. But in Iran, their ancient Persian foe, they have a real threat, and not a mere pretext based on bigotry and political cynicism. Saudi Arabia was in the midst of an extensive cleanup of its medieval regime by the 32-year-old Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, the first Saudi leader not to be a son of King Ibn Saud, who died in 1953. He perhaps recognized the obvious. The Palestinian leaders could have had a state at any time in the last 35 years, if they had been prepared to acknowledge Israel's right to exist as a Jewish state. But they would then have led a very small country. The Palestinian leaders had rejected instant floods of foreign assistance and chose celebrity, personal enrichment, and violence. They had allowed the Palestinian people to be used as cannon fodder, and now they were no longer useful to Saudi Arabia or Egypt, as they were irrelevant to the fight against Iran. Israel posed no threat to Saudi Arabia or Egypt. Iran did. Donald Trump, as was often the case, sliced through the paralysis and pusillanimity of those invested in the stalled status quo, including the State Department, and did what he had promised to do in announcing that the United States Embassy would move to Jerusalem, something his six immediate predecessors had pledged to do and never did. The sanctimony of the British Prime Minister, Theresa May, in denouncing Trump's action as unhelpful was especially galling, given that Britain precipitated the entire problem by promising in the Balfour Declaration of 1917 to make Palestine a homeland for the Jewish people without compromising the rights of the Arabs. They sold the same real estate simultaneously to two rival occupants. Not even Donald Trump in his flamboyant heyday as a Manhattan developer was accused of that. On December 21st, the United Nations General Assembly voted 128-9, with 35 abstentions, that the United States had no right to move its embassy in Israel to Jerusalem. The American ambassador to the United Nations, former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley, who has been an impressive spokesperson in that impossible place, warned that the United States would not continue to pay for the dubious privilege of being disrespected while bankrolling the UN. On Christmas Day, a 25% reduction, $285 million in the annual U.S. contribution to the UN was announced, and there were suggestions that there would be economic reprisals against individual member countries who voted against the United States. Ambassador Haley promised that the vote would be remembered when, as often happens, American assistance is solicited by member countries. With heavy interventions from the White House, Trump's tax reductions and reforms inched through both houses of Congress, were slightly modified, went to reconciliation, and were adopted. Corporate taxes were cut to 21%. Most Americans were left off the federal income tax rolls, and more than 80% of those who remained would see their taxes reduced. Tax forms would be highly simplified, and American companies were given incentives to return up to $3 trillion of overseas profits to the United States. Trump was no less a political hardballer than his Democratic enemies. The bill retained the provisions that overspending states like California, New York, and Illinois would have very reduced deductibility of state and local taxes against federal taxes. Also retained by the final tax bill were modest taxes on the incomes of the vast endowments of America's private universities. Many leading figures in the administration consider a large number of American universities to be infestations of the American self-hating left, where underworked and often seditious and overstuffed faculties churn out undertrained and misdirected graduates on campuses that frequently discourage freedom of expression. Much of American and Western academia was dedicated to the propagation of what the eminent British writer Malcolm Muggeridge 50 years ago called the great liberal death wish. The tax bill also struck out the most offensive core of Obamacare, the coercive mandate that fined those who were not insured. With this, Trump would begin the disembowelment of that measure, with which Obama had addicted much of the country to apparently free medical care, while inciting skyrocketing premiums and the rupture of doctor-patient relations for millions of others. With Trump's massive deregulation, economic growth rhetoric, and gradually solidifying promise of tax cuts and reform, economic growth had reached 3% and would have exceeded that without the devastating hurricanes in Texas and Florida, and would approach 4% in 2018, more than double the Obama-era growth rate. 11 months into his term, the Dow Jones Industrial Average had set a new all-time record on 62 different days, and it broke 25,000 on January 4, 2018, and 26,000 2 weeks later. That indicator had risen since the election by more than 40% at the end of January, representing more than $6 trillion. The Democrats were reduced to their customary railings about a free ride for the rich and their hypocrisy about tax cuts worsening the national debt. Having increased the national debt by $10 trillion, 125%, under Obama's spendthrift administration, they complained of a projected additional increase under Trump, as projected by the Congressional Budget Office, of $1.5 trillion in debt over 10 years, which would occur only if economic growth were just 1.9%, an almost impossibly pessimistic scenario, especially given Trump's sterling record of economic growth during the first 12 months of his administration. The Congressional Budget Office has never predicted anything accurately since the Eisenhower era. The tax bill wasn't popular at first because of the class warfare obloquy the Democratic and media propaganda machine heaped upon it. But there was a growing realization of the bill's benefits for working-class Americans. Polls showed ever more support for the measure, especially as businesses shared their tax relief by rewarding workers with bonuses and raises. Former Speaker Pelosi dismissed these bonuses and raises as crumbs, but they went out to many millions of workers and only showed how out-of-touch Democrats were with what was once their working-class base. Trump's tax bill was, with the Johnson tax reform of 1965, initiated by President Kennedy and the Reagan tax reforms of 1981 and 1986, the most important tax bill in American history and the greatest legislative accomplishment in more than 20 years. Many large companies announced large investments and employment projects in the United States and the repatriation of immense amounts of accrued profit. Apple was the largest early benefactor, bringing back $350 billion and announcing plans to hire 50,000 more Americans. Just as the Republicans were congratulating themselves on their tax triumph, they also had reason to believe that the Democrats' Russian collusion story was turning into a game of Democratic Russian roulette. The full array of Justice Department, special, and congressional investigations was only unearthing embarrassments of the Democrats. As 2018 dawned, the Democrats on the Senate Intelligence Committee were still calling for more witnesses and documents, though they had already collected nearly 300,000 documents and reviewed more than 5,000 pages of testimony taken in 164 hours of hearings from 67 witnesses. None of it produced anything remotely justifying the entire immense wild goose chase they had launched. But the insufferable Senator Warner and his colleagues fervently wished that it continue, even as all the evidence appeared to show that Democrats were guilty of hypocrisy, cynicism, hysteria, and perhaps even collusion themselves in promoting a document, the Steele dossier, chock full of Russian disinformation. At time of writing, the war continues, with the media and the Democrats more hostile and frenzied than ever. Al Hunt, a formerly rational Wall Street Journal writer, wrote for Bloomberg News on December 10th that Trump might, if accused of wrongdoing, whistle his followers out into the streets of America. The implication was that the 63 million people who voted for him would, in large numbers, respond to a call for civil insurrection from the great rabble-rouser. My dear and esteemed friend David Frum remarked on CNN on December 11th that the chief failing of the media in its coverage of Trump was its overzealous ambition to be fair to the president. It is hard to foresee how normally reasonable people could be induced to return to their senses anytime soon, having taken such distant leave of them. The New York Times, scrambling to find cover as the Democrats' collusion narrative collapsed, conjured up the completely spurious theory that the collusion investigation began because of the drunken indiscretions made by a junior Trump campaign advisor, George Papadopoulos, who pleaded guilty to minor offenses, to the former leader of the opposition in Australia, Alexander Downer, in London's Kensington Wine Bar. Papadopoulos' babblings were eventually reported to the State Department, but only after the FBI investigation had begun. The discomfort of the Times and less august members of the resistance in wanting to assign blame for the failing Russian narrative can be gauged by the absurdity of this initiative. The implausible Carl Bernstein hit the speaking and interview circuit yet again on the theme of the constitutional crisis that might require the removal of the president under the 25th Amendment for mental incompetence and instability. It was like the New York Times' Thomas Friedman claiming that the Trump campaign's alleged and utterly unproven Russian collusion was equivalent to Pearl Harbor in the terrorist attacks of 9/11, and Nancy Pelosi calling Trump's tax bill Armageddon and the worst legislative disaster in history. On an even lower level of professionalism and believability was a book by one of the Western world's most malicious and tedious gossips, and one of the sleaziest published authors in American history, Michael Wolff, whom the author has encountered. Wolff purported to quote former White House strategist Steve Bannon, accusing Donald Trump Jr. of treason in the collusion affair. Bannon denied this, but the formerly Bannon-hating anti-Trump media briefly cited him respectfully. And if Bannon had spoken to Wolff in this way, out of hatred for certain factions in the White House, it was a suicide move that made one doubt why Trump had retained him in the first place. Trump tweeted that when Bannon lost his job, he also lost his mind. The night of the publication of excerpts from the book, January 3rd, Bannon was on the air proclaiming that Trump was a great man, whom he still supported. On CNN, correspondent Brian Stelter conceded Wolff's book was sloppy with errors, but claimed that many Trump experts say the book rings true overall. In fact, Fire and Fury made the Steele dossier seem like revelation in its moral authority. To anyone who knew Trump, as this author does, it read like a fabricated, confessedly part-fiction smear job from A to Z. On January 17, 2018, Trump announced his awards of the most corrupt and dishonest political journalists. Paul Krugman of the New York Times won with his election night prediction that the stock markets would never recover from Trump's victory. Among respectable commentators in the press, however, there was a discernible shift away from lunacy. The Wall Street Journal seemed dedicated to common sense, and many of Trump's more measured opponents in the New York Times or at National Review now seemed more interested in setting up a loyal opposition than in reflexive hysteria. In part, this was because such hysteria could not be squared with the facts. Trump completely debunked the argument about his mental competence and stability with a deft 55-minute televised White House discussion with the bipartisan congressional leadership about immigration on January 9th. But even this blew up when Senator Dick Durbin, a few days later, released the claim that Trump had asked why the United States had to accept so many immigrants from shithole countries, which was apparently at least a slight misquotation. But it enabled the president's enemies to accuse him of racism rather than to focus on the president's point, which was that the United States should have a merit-based immigration system that gave preference to immigrants with skills rather than providing a giant welfare state for the world's poor. But whatever harsh language Trump might have used, it was as nothing to the sort of language routinely used by Presidents Truman, Johnson, and Nixon, or even Dick Durbin, who had once called American troops Nazis. And the whole issue was nonsense, which blew over, despite a media frenzy, because Trump's question was likely one held by a majority of Americans as well. It certainly had no perceptible impact on the polls when the government partially shut down on January 20th, because of the Democrats' insistence that they would not vote for a stopgap funding measure unless Congress also voted for the naturalization of 800,000 children brought into the United States by their parents illegally. The shutdown fizzled after one business day, again indicative of how the balance of power in Washington was shifting. In February, Robert Mueller indicted 13 Russians who cannot be extradited for conspiring to defraud the United States by improperly advertising in American social media before and in the election campaign, decrying various conditions of American life and supporting Trump, Sanders, and Green candidate Jill Stein. It was an insignificant, ineffectual bipartisan intervention, and the case will never be tried. Not even the left was excited. It came to light that the Clinton campaign had been feeding misinformation directly to Steele, and that Senator Warner of Virginia, one of the leaders of the spurious collusion narrative, had been attempting, without leaving a paper trail, to deal directly with Steele. There were widespread calls for indictments of Comey and McCabe, and even Hillary Clinton. At last, the dangers of the criminalization of policy differences were being exposed. As the long effort to quarantine Trump failed, the Democratic congressional leadership showed signs of cooperating with the administration and joined in a spending cap agreement that put off